Okay, so I am going to start. So I wanted to spend a little bit of time to talk about sources, because I know you're all looking on your own about certain aspects of the park. Some of you are doing like particular history things, some of you are doing institutions, and some of you are doing things that aren't as like historical and research, more like restaurants and shopping and that kind of thing. But what I wanted to talk to you about is understanding some of the things that you might read about the park on your own. And I've given you some resources that I like and broken them down into category, more about the park and us, more about just centered on the square, and then broader Greenwich Village history. And then finally, a lot of you were talking about images, and these are some really good sources for historic images, particularly where they're digital, so you don't have to go to the location to go get them, which is kind of nice to look through them. You can just do it from the comfort of your armchair. But you know, and I hate to bring you back to history class when you were in ninth grade, but I do want to talk a little bit about understanding some of the things you might read and how to look at things with a critical eye. So even in books or articles or the like that I might suggest, there's always going to be different ways of looking at things by the person who created it that I wanted to just review a little bit. And I wanted to talk about primary sources, and I wanted to talk about secondary sources. So going back to high school and in your history classes, primary sources are those things that are a diary that if I was researching my life, you know, or for someone was doing my biography, they might find my diary that I kept in eighth grade that's really embarrassing with all those little tidbits about what guy I liked and, you know, getting stood up and having too many pimples and all that fun stuff. And that was something that I created as a person, and somebody who's studying me is using this to kind of find out things about my life. Whereas if this biographer of me was doing a little bit more research, they might go and they might say, oh, look, somebody wrote this article about people who ran track in high school, and which I did. And, you know, okay, so here she is in ninth grade and she won this track meet. And somebody wrote this article about students who were doing something, and she's attributed with having done some raucous act, you know, on the school grounds. That's that would be a secondary source, because that would be something that somebody else wrote about me and not me writing about me. So basically, if you want to think about it, something like, let me just pull it, like Emily Kyes Fulp, who you heard from last week, when she wrote her book, if you're using that book to learn about the history, you're using a secondary source. But if you go and you read the footnote and you pull out the note that she put and where did she get that source for her information, that's the primary source that she used to find out that information. So those are the two types of sources. Mostly what you're gonna be reading is secondary sources. But you can find things that are, you know, in notes and bibliographies and things like that, where someone got their source. And you might be looking at some primary sources. So, you know, a couple of weeks ago when we had our first session, we were talking about some people in the neighborhood who aren't too happy with the Conservancy, and they've put it out there in the, you know, in the internet world, you know, the things that they're not happy about the Conservancy doing or being or what have you. That would be a primary source about, you know, what rumors are, or what, you know, people are thinking about the Conservancy that's out there. So I just want you to be looking with a critical eye and thinking with a critical eye when you're kind of, you know, kind of out there and experiencing the park. And people are going to talk to you too while you're being a greeter, while you're being a guide. And what they say, they might have something of complete interest about the park, but you don't know what their source is and et cetera. So, you know, it's like two kind of competing, you know, thinkings going on. So what are the types of things you're supposed to think about when you're reading these different sources? And it holds true for primary, and it holds true for secondary as well. So the first thing you're supposed to look at is when. When was this written? When was this spoken? When was this source? When, you know, like, when was it created? Because there's a lot of different, like, was it at the time? You know, so if we're looking at, for instance, in our talk tonight, John said that they found some notes from neighbors who reported that, we don't know that, you know, they were doing some sandblasting. We don't know when those notes were given to the Parks Department. Was it given like 5 years later? Was it given at the same time? I'd want to know when that source came and said there was sandblasting. So like, did it happen on a Tuesday and like their letter was written the next Wednesday and said, you know, yesterday on blah, blah, blah date. So
I was a little confused with that.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, he was talking about hearsay or and then he framed it as it really was sandblasted.
And I was actually going to ask and I didn't.
So you two were a little...
I was, yeah. And that's thinking with a critical or listening or reading with a critical eye about, is that, how accurate is that?
Well, but he framed it as
he did.
They did sandblast, and that's why.
Yes, yeah, he did, and it's a good question.
So,
whether they had other sources of information, if when they looked at the
how they
structure, like if they could see that this is, you know, what usually happens when this technique is used with this type of material, you know, we don't know if there were other corroborating sources for that information. That's thinking critically. And that's exactly what I want you to do when you're listening.
But in all honesty, do you think that kind of minutiae is going to
come up? No.
I mean,
no.
I think it's interesting in this milieu, but certain people
this
who
are
coming to the park, I can't imagine.
This is our way of helping you become experts
right
on a subject. So, no, I don't think you'll ever have to say that to somebody. But if someone comes up and says, for instance, Parks is bad. They just mess everything up. Everything they do, everything they touch, something is screwed up, right? I know for a fact that back in the 1960s, the Parks sandblasted, and you can say, yes, Parks, when they did the renovation, thinks that that very well could have happened. But that does not mean that Parks screws everything up. That's just one example, you know? So it's just, I'm just trying to like have you have a way of thinking here to kind of help you be an expert about something. That's all.
Well, the experts are always learning too.
Exactly. The experts that bring you here might say things that we're not going to use as fact. So for instance, Emily Fulp said the park opened in 1826. Now Parks has the date 1827 for becoming a park/parade ground, and that's the date we're gonna use because we're gonna go by Parks because we're a Parks group. So there's differences in a lot of different things, and when you guys are done, I'm actually gonna give you a fact sheet that's gonna be our, like, you know, this is our fact sheet, these are the facts that we use kind of thing, and this is why. But So thinking about when was the source of something, where was it produced? So could a book written about Greenwich Village from a writer who lives in London have some, you know, like different thoughts about looking at that particular community? Yes, they're going to have a different kind of cultural mindset. Actually, could be helpful, you know, because it's not so localized, you know, but it's a way of you know, shaping information where you're from and where something is produced. Who did it? So when we finished our presentation last week, we were talking about the fact that Emily was an art historian by training. She showed us a lot of art in the images. So art certainly shaped her view of the history of the park. So it's not necessarily a, you know, well, you can't take what she says because she's an art historian. It's more like, understanding the way in which the whole thing is shaped, when you understand who's the author. And then again, going back to those notes, bibliographies, what pre-existing material was analyzed to get to these notions. So if you read something on a blog about the city, and it's kind of interesting, it seems to have some interesting facts, but it cites no sources, then don't use that as a source because it hasn't given you the trail back to something. So there's a lot of different places on the internet that say the American elm tree in the northwest corner of the park was a hanging elm. I can't find any sources anywhere.
I'm sorry, what?
A hanging elm, that there were hangings on that tree. So, and people call it, and it's still known as the hanging tree when there's
no
evidence anywhere. Right, exactly. And actually, so, and some people will say, well, you know, it was a potter's field, so they might as well just, but that part of the park we know wasn't even part of the potter's field. That was the western half of the, if here's the park square, and here's the arch, we know Minetta Brook came this way. You remember that map that Emily showed us? This part was private land. It wasn't part of this potter's field. So west of Minetta Brook. So why was a tree on private property being used for hangings? That makes no sense at all either. So, you know, so thinking about critically, you know, where the facts are coming from.
One guy claimed to have witnessed it from Leroy Street. Leroy Street is blocks and blocks and blocks away from the park.
Mm-hmm.
Way west of the south.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So we can't take that as an eyewitness if he says he's witnessed it from Leroy Street. It makes no sense. Yeah. What was the original form in which it was produced? So was it?
Can you hear? You guys hear the?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Wow. So was it somebody's diary that they made themselves that was meant for public, was meant for private consumption? So like, if I'm writing my diary as an eighth grader and I don't expect that my brother's going to get it and tell my friends about it, I'm going to be very, open with my diary, right? I'm going to be like putting out all my fears and concerns. But if the source is an autobiography, I might want to tell a story about myself that's a little bit different than, you know, what I'm really thinking on the inside. So thinking about what form it was, kind of, that came out, you know. And I think that's particularly important for primary sources, a little less so for secondary sources, but even like the older you get, you know, like the older a book gets, you know, was it a book that was self-published? Was it a book that was, you know, like was it a major publisher who did it? Things like that, I think, are, you know, something to consider. What's the credibility of the person who kind of put it out there? So, is this person a journalist? Is this person, have a relationship to? So obviously I'm telling you that people have concerns about the Conservancy. I'm an employee of the Conservancy. I don't want you to have concerns about the Conservancy. I want you guys to think we're great, but I'm an employee of the Conservancy. So I have that kind of, you know, I might not be the most credible person to tell you that the Conservancy is fine. There's nothing wrong with what we do. So what's that person, do they have an angle? Might they have an agenda? There's always bias, you know, there's always like something that you're not thinking because of who we are and what we know and all that. But is there a very, very, outward bias, you know, could there be not bias? It's like, you know, when you hear like the Orange Growers Association of America found that orange growing is really like when you all, that's all you grow on a particular plot of land for continuously forever. That's actually really good for the lab. We did a study and, you know, that's not the best person to do a study about the effect of orange trees on a particular plot of land. So just understanding any outward bias and credibility that the author of the thing might have had. So these are just ways of thinking critically about some of the things that you read and some of the things that you hear. And just going forward, even in our lectures and our talks, I want you to be thinking critically. Particularly things that aren't kind of the established way that we want to talk about the park. Like if I hear any of you saying like, oh yeah, it was a hanging tree, I'm gonna kill you. Because we're smart enough to know that we can use that episode to say, yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Why does this particular tree have this kind of erroneously labeled history of being a hanging tree? It's really, why do you think? And like, it's a great way to like talk, you know, to people about a story and about the kind of weird, you know, cultural meanings that attach themselves to things. But I want you guys to be critical thinkers and not just, you know, absorb anything that you see out there and think of it as fact, is the point of this whole thing. So one of the sources I gave you for history of the park and the square, there is a series of oral histories. Under the history of the park square, it's the second, third, and fourth items there. They're really interesting. And one of them is Jane Jacobs, which, you know, is like a lion of, you know, preservation movement of village history. Shirley Hayes, these are all people who kind of worked on a project to stop the traffic from coming through the park. Oral histories, I'd love for you to read them because they're really interesting, but oral histories can be really tough sources, you know, as like a way of thinking about what is true and what isn't true, because there are people who are, one, they're usually looking back at a time from like, you know, a span of like, and in this case, this is like, the interview is taken in 2097 and 98, and they're talking about a time that was in the late 50s. So this is a span of a lot of years. So we go back to that, when was the source written, when was it produced? It was produced fairly recently, but they were thinking back to a time that was a long time ago. So memories have a funny way of changing over time. You'll also find in oral histories this kind of, I like to call it the hero story or the anti-hero story. So, you know, when you like tell stories about something that happened, like at Christmas dinner, or like somebody like ruined something, or that famous holiday when like your brother, like, actually we have one in my family where my friend of our family like rolled the turkey like onto the floor after it was already cooked, you know, but you like to tell these stories and you like to, one, make yourself into the hero of the story. We all do this, you know, as time goes by, like we like to think of ourselves as doing good or like advancing something or making a difference. In oral histories, you will very, very, very often find the hero story. And it could be the whole thing, or it could be just like tiny like stories in there where it's like they're talking about a time when they were like, wow, I did that, you know, and it's very proud and it's very amazing. But you have to take some of those hero stories with a little bit of a grain of salt, because they might not be exactly as they remember them. And I'm sure as you think about it, you can think of stories that you tell about yourself or a family member that turn out kind of the same way. And the anti-hero story is the kind of the other way around. So if in this particular case, they're fighting for something and there might be an anti-hero that they're creating in the story. So the person who is on the opposite side of them, who might not be as big a villain as they're talking about, the way they tell it, it's probably a little bit more nuanced, right? So if you're on like two sides of a story, there's usually some pretty good nuances there. I always like to compare it to like when a couple gets divorced, like one person tells one story and another tells another, but probably it's more of like this, like, yeah, there's not one truth, it's a couple things coming together. So, yeah. And then another thing with oral history that you need to be careful with is confirming names, dates, and places. You know, those are the types of things that just go right out of your head. Those are really bad things. Like, you don't remember those accurately. And oftentimes, the person who transcribes the interview will try to confirm them, and there'll often be notes in an oral history where it says, they're probably referencing this, which when I looked it up is, you know, so, but if they're not, if it's not like a really well done project and it's just the interview thrown out there, just try and find another source to corroborate. And oftentimes names aren't spelled correctly in an oral history because, you know, you're listening to it. And so if the transcriber doesn't go back and, you know, confirm the name, then sometimes that can be an issue too. So, and then just again looking at the dates of what happened versus the dates of when they're interviewing, because that's and thinking about it, not just length of time, but what was going on at those different time periods. Was there something at the time that they're doing the interview that is kind of reinforcing the way they're thinking about this past thing? So maybe it's an election and they're thinking about, they were, you know, an elected official, and they're thinking about their past elections, but there's like a really controversial election happening at the same time. So those like kind of current issues at the time of the interview can be informing the way they're thinking about the memories of the, this is all very complex. And this is why, you know, like historians, when you use the word fact, we're like, ha ha ha, you know, that's a fact. But you know, everybody puts bias into their, whether it's a firsthand source or a secondhand source, you know, there's things that can be trusted in a lot of ways, and then there's things that, you know, have things that you need to pay attention to. But very quickly, and then we can get out of here. I'm going to read to you, and you all have this. This is from the archaeologist report, and she's talking about basically the one execution we know happened in or around Washington Square Park in 1822. A gallows is said to have been located in the cemetery, meaning the Potter's Field, where a black woman, Rose Butler, a murderer, was hanged in 1822. A somewhat dubious source for this information is an account by an old gentleman who, from his front stoop on Leroy Street, had observed the hanging from a considerable distance 70 years earlier. So he's recounting it 70 years after the fact, talking about seeing it from his stoop on Leroy Street. He probably doesn't even see the congruent, you know, like he's not on Leroy Street then, so he's not noticing the fact that that was weird.
He might have forgotten the street.
Exactly. More information comes from Reminiscence of an Octogenarian, where its author, Charles H. Haswell, note the source, he's reminiscing 80 years, that Rose Butler, a Negro, was indeed hanged in the Potter's Field, but for arson, not murder. And while we're able to locate a gallows, while this person is able to locate a gallows site near the arch, another historian writes that it's in the vicinity of the modern fountain. What our archaeologist, Joan Geismar, who you saw the picture of, says, once again, neither the published minutes of the Common Council, that's like the current city council, nor this kind of great, it's called the Iconography of Manhattan Island. It was like a big, big, like, historical tome, document a gallows on the Potter's Field. There's newspaper accounts of, and they're wildly varying. Basically what we should get out of this as critical thinkers is that there's one reputable source, which is the city council, which maybe has a little bit of a bias in this incident, because this is an area where there are some wealthy people living, kind of juxtaposed next to Minetta, where a lot of black people are living, and this is a Negro, quote unquote, as she's called. Then who is hanged for arson. But what we get out of it is we know that there's one person that we can document being hanged in and around the park for most likely arson. But we don't know where the gallows was, and we know it wasn't the tree because the tree wasn't on the property of the Potter's Guild at the time. So what I'm saying is you have to look at a lot of different things to get to what is what we're going to call our ultimate truth, because we have to be as careful with this as we can, just because we're kind of official representatives of, you know, the history of Washington Square Park.
It's always nice to finish something by saying, as far as we know.
Exactly. As far as we know. Who knows? It could have happened every other week, but there's no documentation of it, so we can't be. Yeah. And that's where it's fun to kind of throw out the, well, what do you think? Why do you think that? Here's why I'm not going to agree, you know? I worked at a historic site related to Nathan Hale, the person known as like an American hero who was hanged during the Revolutionary War as a spy for the U.S., what becomes the U.S. And in a house where he had never lived, but his family owned, is this silhouette that was done right on the door of one of the rooms. And everyone said it was Nathan Hale. And it's very unlikely because the house was built after he had kind of already gone to war. And so, like, where did the picture come from and all that? And it was a great, like, kind of teaching moment for, like, how that story had gotten passed down over the years. Just kind of, like, our hanging though, I think, is a great story for how things kind of accumulate over the years. And you can't discount the concept of cultural memory, which is going to be very strong in everyone who's coming to the park who's lived there and kind of had a history with the park, because they'll say, well, Washington Square Park has always been like this. And they might be thinking of their always as like their span of time where they've lived there or interacted with it, or kind of what people are talking about, how Washington Square has always been now, you know, not how it's been now, but how people are talking about how it's always been now. Which is hard to say, but cultural memory is hard to get out of people's heads, and it can be a real force for argument about how a place should be used or how a place is, you know, the history about how we should talk about it, which is why we will have some official kind of, this is what we actually know about the park. And when people want to argue and say, but it's always been a place of dissent, and now there's no room for people to come and protest, and say, well, there was a protest here 2 weeks ago, and there are a lot of competing uses for this park. It's a public park. So that's my...
Times change.
That's my stick. I hope this was helpful and not too, like, remembering, like, bad history lessons back when you were in, back when you were in high school, but I think we just need to remember it to become, you know, critical thinkers about what we're seeing out there in the nether world of the internet, etc. And even with people who have spent a lot of time studying and working on a particular area, too. So, thank you.
And then, you know, in the end, if we're going to, each group is going to be made up of a very diverse audience.
Mm-hmm.
Foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
Who have no concept
of the history. Yep.
And even natives who don't have a concept of American history. So,
and one person who thinks they know
everything.
That's
right. And then they have to come up with a script that's going to be one size fits all, unfortunately.
Well, it's one of the nice things about having however different many tour guides, is because you'll all come at it with a different perspective. And so our first tours are gonna be fairly basic. They're not gonna be like, you know, like studying the, you know, the renovation of the arch, you know, that specific. And that's okay. As the program grows, you know, and we have more people, we might be able to offer more kind of specific tours as we learn more and wanna do more. But
I guess it would be a learning experience to see who comes and what people are receptive to.
One of the things I was thinking about was, you know, when I started to formulate an idea is, I think I'm going to ask everybody where they're from.
Absolutely.
I think that's going to be, because that is going to probably set more of a tone.
Yeah.
Or like if you have a lot of kids, or if you have more foreigners.
Right.
I know, because I speak fast, I'll talk slower. You know, little nuances like that. So yeah, it's going to be a lot to think about. Louder, for your elderly people.
Tell them to come to the front. Yeah. You're going to have to say, gather around at every single stop you make, because they'll start that way, and then by the second stop, they'll all be up, and you'll be like, I'm closer, I'm going to lose my voice if you don't. Yeah.
And I the other thing I'm thinking of is, I really want to, make it fun. I want to figure out a way to make it fun, because you know, if someone's rambling on, it could be as interesting as hell. But you stop caring.
Just like funny to mention this.
I've been talking with Julie. I know Circle Line. And the man who gave the narration.